Thank you, Jamie. I would like to thank the organizing committee for the invitation and also thank the Nobel Foundation again for the sponsorship. It was very nice. Before I start my presentation here, as you can see, I try to cover a pretty broad range here, that is tropical and subtropical regions. And I will not be specific about one species. And I will focus my presentation on warm season perennial grasses, although I would like to acknowledge that in these regions we have also different species that are also important, such as warm season annual grasses or legumes, annual or perennial. And in some of the subtropical regions, you can still have the chance to have some cool season forages as annuals. But because of the sake of time, I will focus my presentation on perennial warm season grasses. So this will be the outline of my presentation. And I also would like to point out that I'll try to decrease the amount of data on the presentation, knowing that I was the last one. Well, it's changing by itself. Okay, I will control right here. Because I knew that was the last one in the program, by now, you know, people are pretty much ready to go to lunch, so I try to decrease the amount of data, so I will have to share with you more ideas, and you can make me responsible for those that have a lot of personal opinion on it. Just a brief map here to tell you the region that I'm going to cover. Between the tropics there is probably the region that we find most of the warm season perennial grasses. As you can see, the United States, although the southeast, we have a lot of presence of Bermuda grass and some other warm season grasses. That is not really included in their region, and that's the reason why when we come to present here, the species that we try to cover are not very popular. Right? We talk a lot about fescue and alfalfa. When I talk about limpo grass, I can see people leaving the room, but that is the reality, and that's the type of species that we work on, primarily because of resilience. We just work with them, not because we like them, it's because that's the choice that we have, and that's the ones that are persistent in our climate. And I'll figure this out by the end. And here you can see the main reason why those warm season perennial grasses are dominant in this climate is because of temperature. You can see that this map here will overlap with the previous map that I just presented to you, and you can see the warmer regions where these warm season perennial grasses are adapted. So, and we have a huge variation in temperature, altitude, and rainfall. But nonetheless, we can see that these different species of warm season perennial grass, they are distributed along that area. I also would like to point out that we have warm season perennial grasses up to Minnesota, right? But I will just cover where they are really the majority of the forages used for beef cattle. So this is to illustrate the importance of those grasses, and primarily because of their resilience. This is the beef cattle production in the world. And if you see the countries here, you're going to see that probably if you put the top three, 50% of the beef cattle production in the world comes from the tropical and subtropical region. And you still have a lot of places like Australia, Uruguay, and Argentina that also have a lot of subtropical areas that are also based on warm season perennial grasses. So we assume that warm season perennial grasses may be responsible for up to 50% of the livestock production in the earth. I will start just with some examples about some species. If you are familiar with those, fine. Otherwise, I'll give you a brief explanation for you. Brachiaria grasses that are not popular in the United States, they are the most planted warm season perennial grass in the earth. So they are very dominant in most regions going from Australia to South America. And according to Miles, they were used for pastoral working in Africa for a long time and also for wildlife. And in the 60s and 70s, that started the interest in regions, tropical regions such as Australia and South America, the CIT in Colombia, to try to select and breed those brachiaria grasses. And And the main reason is because this grass can take a lot of abuse. That's the main reason why brachiaria became so popular. If you can see here, this is the beef cattle production in Brazil. That is more than 90% of the beef cattle production in Brazil is conducting brachiaria grasses. You can see from the 60s to 70s there, the increase in beef cattle population as in meat production. And I know there are other factors involved in this growth, but we can't deny that probably the brachiaria is the main factor leading to this increase in beef cattle production in that region. Another one that I would like to mention, another example is buffalo grass, that we have some here in the United States if you go to South Texas. And buffalo grass is also from Africa, and it was coming to Australia around the 50s, although they have some introduction that was not volunteered, but they assumed that by the 50s, buffalo grass became the main forage in northern Australia. We have here in South Texas, also because it's very drought tolerant, so we can take long periods with no rainfall. And this is a picture of buffalo grass intercropped with lupina in the western part of Queensland in Australia. And the recommendation in this area is to mix panicum, buffalo grass, and Rhodes grass at seeding. So you plant the lupina, and then next year you come and overseed the combination of these three species. And I was curious to know why. It's pretty much because of the germination rate of those. But the truth is, after 3 years, you have a pure stand of buffalo grass. So that's why buffalo grass is so adapted to this place. And again, going on the persistence standpoint, it's really dominant in these regions. And the last one is Bermuda grass here in the southeastern U.S. that we can't deny that is probably the most used species. And one thing that makes Bermuda grass, I think, so popular, it's because in the Bermuda grass family, you're going to see this wide variety of things. The cultivars, you can see some upright, you can see thicker stems, you can see some that has more rhizomes, less rhizomes. And this makes these species really adapted to a range of environment and makes it very flexible. So where we are located in South Florida, because of poorly drained soils, Bermuda grass was never very popular, differently from North Florida and other regions in the southeastern U.S. But now we did some trials 3 years in a very high input system, harvesting this forage every 6 weeks, and we try all these different warm season forages here. You can see the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth, they are all Bermuda grasses. So that is Jigs, Floracurve, T25, and Coast Cross 2. And they were all very productive, but I have to point out that Jigs was the only one that persisted through the trial. Although they were very productive when we started with, the other Bermuda grasses started decreasing the stand. It's because we identified the Jigs, that is originally from East Texas, is one Bermuda grass that can tolerate some poorly drained soils. So in general, we don't assume that Bermuda grass will do well in the environment, but we found out that Jigs, it is adapted, and now Jigs is probably the most planted species for hay production and silage in South Florida. As I mentioned to you, the temperature has been probably the most significant factor, persistence of these C4 forages. And we have seen that global warming became like a political conversation, right? But you, if you agree or disagree or deny or not, so that's a fact, and it's happening. And we have seen some reports from the literature that this increase in temperature is shifting the population where you have a mixture of C4, C3. The dominance of C4 is starting showing up, primarily because it's more adapted to high temperatures. So we have two reports here in the literature that really has a good report about this shift in C4 grasses population when we have increasing temperatures over time. And now I will switch to some mechanisms of adaptation. The C4 carbon cycle, that is probably the the responsible for this grass to be very aggressive in the growing. They have three different main decarboxylation systems that I will not bother you with all these biochemical systems here, but I would like to focus on the first one, NADPME malic and NAD malic. Those are the ones that we have a lot of forages in it. And the main difference is the way that these enzymes do the decarboxylation between the mesophyll and the bundlesheath. And here are some of the NADP malic. And these grasses, this on the first one here is Andropogon in Brazil, or Ipahinia, this is a rufa, but it can be different species in South Africa and Mozambique. And the last one is Sorghastrum here in North America. You can see they have similar architecture and they have the same physiological pathway of decarboxylation. So they are all bunch grasses, and it is documented that these grasses grow really well in places that have high rainfall but low inputs. So, and we also have found that that those grasses, they do well in conditions where they have limited nitrogen presence, despite the fact that when you have some environments, the fertile soils, and they have still a little less rainfall, you may end up with plants more dominant. They are the NID malic, that, for example, Bermuda grass. And Penicillium is another species including that in that geological pathway. And it is hypothesized that if you have a NAD malic plant, it has a greater nitrogen requirement. So if you are thinking about those ecosystems that I show you, and most of the beef cattle production in the earth in that subtropical and tropical region is low input system, you can probably consider that those differences in decarboxylation pathway may be a factor to consider in those selection and use of those plants. And also associated with the physiological, we can't deny that the morphology is really important. These grasses that we grow and persist in our climate, we have seen that they have those reserve structures that can accumulate carbon and nitrogen and other nutrients. So when you have these periods of stress, the plant can use it, those nutrients. And he also observed that the meristematic points are really close to the ground. So you put those together and you're going to find a plant that may persist under grazing situations, and most times under stressful grazing situations. This is just some data. I will show little data, but I promise you that I will not hammer you with numbers. This is just an example of a recent publication with Tifton 85. When we did a pretty good nitrogen fertilization on it, you can see the proportion of nitrogen above ground and below ground is very similar. When you look at the carbon on the bottom, you can see that we have probably as much twice carbon underground than above ground. So it's a lot of reserve structures there in the rhizome and stem that will make this plant quite resilient to grazing and defoliation. This is another example, but the opposite. So this is Bahia grass, and this work was done by Cindy Interant in Florida with Bahia grass. And we have two harvest frequencies there, 7 or 21 days, and two stubble heights, 4 or 8. You can see Argentina is our standard for persistence. It has been a plant that has a lot of rhizomes. It's really tough. When we compare the Pensacola, that is a diploid, we can see that when we stress this plant and we harvest every 7 days at 4 centimeter stubble height, you can see that we decrease the ground cover, primarily because that plant doesn't have as much reserves as the Argentine. However, if you don't stress the plant, you can see that the ground cover will be quite similar. So ground cover and those reserves are really well related in order to make a plant that will persist. And I had a video here, as you can see right now, the technology is not helping me much here, moving the slide. So this video will not play, and we try. But the other thing that I would like to mention to you, this is a dairy farm in South Florida, grazing dairy. So we established those Penicillium purpureum pastures for the producer. This is elephant grass, very productive, great nutritive value, but we know it's not very persistent under intense grazing. So while we come here for 3 years, this is 8 years now, but I come here in the spring and we do the first grazing together. What we do, we leave stems. Can you see the stems there? The old stems? So what that means is if you are a forage manager, you're gonna think, well, stems are bad, right? Stems is something that has low nutritive value and they will decrease the quality, so that's a bad thing. However, in this scenario here, our stems help to protect those pastures. So even if the producer made some mistake, those stems will not let those cows to graze it down and kill the plant. So thinking about that, we have been breeding for leaf to decrease or increase the leaf to stem ratio, when sometimes in this scenario here, having some stems is really important to protect the plant. I will just show you what happened in this video. If you see that cow with the head low there, there are two leaves there. And that cow has been there trying to get those two leaves for a little while. And I was recording. And it could not, because it has the stems poking her when she put her head down. So that is pretty good example of what that structure of the canopy can do for you to protect the grass from being grazed. Now I will touch a little bit about the breeding and selection. And I would like to point out to you that that is not a criticism to the breeders for any reason, and I include myself in that scenario. So it's just, I think, observation. If you look at history of breeding, for sure it start in Europe, right, when they have forages, and then moved northern United States for northern locations, and then finally came to down south where people tried to explore new land, and they faced the C4 grasses or the warm season. So in the mind, in history, you're going to see they start over there with a perennial ryegrass and alfalfa, and then they get back in the south and they have something that looks like bamboo, right? So the idea is this is bad, right? This is low quality. But I think we have to see that in the context because everything is relative, right? And people have been blaming the warm season grasses because it's bad. It has low quality. But the thing is, what do you want to feed, you know? What is the requirement? And what is the target? For example, we have Bahia grass in South Florida that is enough to keep a mature cow breeding every year and keep the body condition. So everybody blames the Bahia grass is low nutritive value, but it's not, because it can keep us producing calf a year for a long period of time. So it may be bad compared to alfalfa on the nutritive value, but it's not. And for that reason, we have seen that the breeding programs really focus on increasing production and nutritive value. So that has been the bread and butter of the thing. We need to make this thing better, with better nutritive value, when sometimes I don't see that as the main priority, because if something die and is not there, what is the nutritive value? Right? You just talk about nutritive value if you have the forage, but if you don't have it, I think we don't need to go to that conversation. So I think the main factor is it needs to survive, right? So, and that's why when I mentioned those examples for you at the start of my presentation in Brazil, Australia, and here in the Southeastern, we never mention about nutritive value, correct? We just talk about those forages because they doesn't die, right? They don't die on those environments. They are persistent. That's why we focus on them. And we have seen a considerable amount of cultivars that have been tested and released, right, over time with a lot of fertilizer and doing the optimum grazing. That means frequency, intensity. So those grasses are managed to be really productive. And there is nothing wrong with that because we have a market, right, for producers that are more intensive. They have high input systems. And they may like those grasses to increase the production, right? And that may be something important. However, we have a great majority of these livestock being produced in tropical and subtropical areas that are all in low input systems. So we are focused, I think, a lot of our breeding and selection in a small amount of clientele where we have this big, large portion that is screaming for something that is persistent and still a good forge. And that's what I just mentioned to you. And when we go to the literature to try to get some data on persistence of a warm season forages, you're going to see you can have probably one hand where you're going to show some data looking at persistence. We see a lot of production, nutritive value, physiological pathways, but very little on persistence and how these grasses behave under defoliation. And we also have to blame on us, right? Because we do a two-year research, and then we wanted to publish the paper, so we don't go further to the point that we're going to see those impacts on persistence. So that is my picture of our breeding program here. So we try to create a fast car that is very nice and comfortable, and then we try to put a Brahman steer on it and drive around. So that may be something similar what I'm trying to communicate with you. So, and I think we may try to breed also for some F-150, the Pua stock trailer, that will not be as comfortable, not as fast, but will do the heavy work that sometimes we need. So this is just some research data in what I mentioned to you. Here we have again Bahia grass, Argentine, Pensacola. Argentine is a tetraploid, Pensacola is a diploid, and then UF Riata was a cultivar release for improved fall forage production, right? And this is the root and rhizome mass, and these plants were grazed at 2 weeks or 4 weeks, and they were grazed at 3 centimeters stubble height, so really close to the ground. You're going to see here, when you graze at 4 weeks, there was no difference in root and rhizome mass, so the plant did well. But when you go to 2 weeks, the plants that were selected for greater growth, they have less root and rhizome mass. So the stress that we gave on grazing, we pretty much select plants that may have less below ground reserves, but will have probably a better growth for above ground, and that may be a problem for persistence later in the life of this pasture here. And here I would just like to throw a animal science, a beef cattle management concept here. Some of you are familiar with this. This is called RFI, relative feed intake. So when people are trying to find out individuals, and here I will explain to you what that means, the residual food feed intake, you can have zero, that is the expected, that this animal will eat. If you go above, this animal will eat more than expected. If you go below, they will eat less than expected. On the X, actually you're going to see the expected every daily gain. That's what we have. And we have 4 different quadrants here. So you have animals that eat a lot and gain a lot, right? But you also have animals here that will eat very little and gain very little. So are they efficient? Probably, right? Or you may have animals that eat very low and gain more weight, right? And then they are focusing on trying to find those animals and select them. They are very efficient on eating less and gaining more. And I'm just throwing this there because I think that's probably maybe a good model for plant selection, right? We may have probably now, because inputs are so expensive, fertilizer is with no doubt the most expensive input in forage production. So I think we need to consider something like this in order to make a selection, right? A plant that may not uptake as much nitrogen or any other nutrients and you still have a considerable growth and production. So with that in mind, we have some people working with genetics that they have identified some genes that are responsible for nitrogen use efficiency in corn and rice. Those are the ones that I selected to show. So they identify that gene for nitrogen use efficiency in a plant, and then they do a GMO plant with the inclusion of those genes in experimental approach, and they have nitrogen use efficiency on that plant. There has been a very effective approach. So this is for corn and rice, as I said, that are very popular crops. So what we are doing in Florida, we have limpo grass that is a forage that is very particular for South Florida, that grows well in wet areas. And the Florida Cattlemen Association has a lot of interest for this grass. So we try, we have now four cultivars. The first two are new cultivars that we just released in 2014. And we release because they have a greater production and greater nutritive value. Floralta is a standard, and number one is a cultivar that we didn't release. But we saw some very positive attributes in that number one that led us to keep working on it. And you're going to see here, we tested three different genes. We use PCR and identify specific genes. And we try to see using the primer from corn. And we try to see if there are the expression of those genes in these limpograss plants that may help us to identify plants that are more nutrient efficient. And we finally found that although the data is not conclusive because it's the opposite, so the plants that grew more, they have less expression of the genes for nitrogen use efficient. But we can see that the two plants that grow much more, they have a very distinct expression of those genes. So I think we need further investigation here, but I think we can use some of the ideas from corn and rice and other crops to try to architect this warm season perennial grasses that will be more efficient in using nitrogen, for example. Okay, the last one is resilience and invasiveness. So in Florida, and I think around the southeastern U.S., you are very concerned about the invasiveness of those plants because we wanted the same characteristics, right? For a good pasture and for a bad pasture, and we wanted just to survive. And in general, they overlap, right? A good forage may be invasive forage. So just here are some examples of how these forages can grow. And I live in Hardy County. If you're not familiar, it's a really country location. And this is what I was taking at the gas station over there. So we don't have green roofs like they have in civilized places. So that is actually broom sedge. They just grew in that roof there, and the lady is trying to get rid of it. So that's just some examples how these grasses can be really aggressive growing and persist under very adverse conditions. And for that reason, we have some discouragement now to introduce new species or to select for some characteristics because these grasses are considered to be invasive. And I have just some questions here. How are we going to say that this grass is invasive? It is not a forage, right? What are the criteria that we need to use to distinct between those two? And the other two questions is, who is making those decisions, right? Do we have a lot of forage management people included? Because if it's a forage, I understand that we may have landscape plants that may be invasive, right? But most times we have forages that are considered invasive. So is the forage management community participating in those decisions? And I think that is a self-criticism. If we are not, we should. And then we can probably help to make those decisions regarding a forage. And I'll just give you an example from Florida. In around 1940s, Bahia grass arrived in Florida through the Pensacola Bay, that's the theory, and took over the whole state. So you will not find a place in Florida that you don't see a Bahia grass. Or if it's in your backyard, or in your flower bed, in your pasture, anywhere in Florida, you're going to find a Bahia grass. There is an old saying from the center director at ONA that say there are just two types of forages in Florida. Bahia grass and a pasture that will be Bahia grass. So that's pretty simple. And that's the truth because it is. We can call that invasiveness, but that is the backbone of our beef cattle production. So we need Bahia grass to survive there in this environment. But on the same area, we have Congo grass that, in fact, it was introduced. The theory is it was introduced by an RCS, but I don't find the reports. But in that publication there from 1997, they said the Congo grass was introduced as a forage and as a cover for erosion. So Congo grass is not forage and is not good cover. you know, and it's really invasive. That is the main problem that we have in Florida right now, and it was introduced. So I know that that happens many years ago, but I think we need to work together to avoid those things, because that is a really serious problem for the state right now. And now, on my final remarks here, for sure, what we talk about here, again, I didn't mention a lot of quantity and quality, because I truly believe this resilience and persistence of warm season grass, that makes the warm season perennial grass important. If they die, that doesn't work. We have these physiological and morphological characteristics that may lead that plant to be more persistent under a specific environment. So I think we need to explore those in order to make decisions and to breeding and selecting new plants. And I see there two ways that we can think about it. A plant needs to be a good forage if you work with forage management, and resilient. If it's resilient and it's not a good forage, it's a weed, right? And that will be very difficult to control. So probably we should go first and check if that plant is a good forage and will bring something new to the ecosystem, and then test the resilience of that plant to see if that will get off hand and that may become a weed. So I think those are two important concepts that they need to come together. You know, if you have a good forage that is not resilient, that will not work in our climate as well. Beef cattle producers, mainly most of livestock producers, if it dies, they try to get something perennial, they assume for the rest of their life. That doesn't happen, but that's the expectation. So if something doesn't really persist, it'll be very difficult to be a successful forage in these tropical and subtropical areas. I would like to thank you for your attention, and I'll turn it back to the chair. Okay.
A few minutes for any questions for Dr. Benjamin. It's before lunch.
I agree with your last statement 100%, but I also know that some of our folks who do this invasive species assessment would make the argument that there are other places where plants become invasive that you'll never have a grazing animal to control them. I think the classic example is kudzu. Kudzu fits your definition of being a good forage and maybe not so resilient if you've got cows on it. But it became a weed when it jumped over the fence and got in the pine forest. And so we have to be careful, I think, about that aspect of it, that when it jumps outside of where you're going to have an animal that would normally control it.
Yeah.
Kudzu is not invasive.
Effect,
it's the opposite.
It goes away. Yeah, and I agree. The comment is, if a plant that you select for a certain ecosystem just go across the fence and have a different crop, a different environment, that was not a weed here, but that become a weed, and for sure that needs to be considered through the selection process, right? And that is, if you do a selection process, for example, we had mulatto, that is a brachiaria in Florida, and brachiarias are known for being really resilient and invasive. So we did 5 years of research where we tried to cover all these. I didn't do it because I like, I need to be honest with you. I did do because I want the funds to do grazing research. So I tried to get on the invasive side of the things, but that's the truth. But what we did for 5 years, we tested that plant under all different environments, to the point Dr. Solenberger did work in Gainesville, we did work in Mariana. We found out that plant, if it goes much further, will be a biennial, will not tolerate cold weather. And if it's flooded, will die. And the seed production is very limited, and only 3% of the seeds are viable. So we put all of that together. Roundup will control 97% of the time and will not bounce back. So when you put all that together after 5 years, right, you can have a pretty good idea. But then if you jump to the pine trees, you apply Roundup, and I think it's a good control, will not be there. On the side, common grass is everywhere, is in native land. You go there, you spray Roundup, and it's like you do nothing. will die and will bounce back even better, spread around. So I think with some assessment and some effort, we can have a pretty good idea if that will become a weed, you know, out of control. Yes, sir.
What is your experience with, one of the biggest complaints of producers with tropical and subtropical is it's not always the protein. Sometimes the protein you can manage that, but the fiber and the lignin as well. So, because I think that sometimes it's, it could be counterproductive. We think about resilience and fiber. We know that for those conditions, the fiber gets.
Yeah, the question is about the nutritive value of those forages, primarily on the fiber concentration that producers are concerned about the decrease in energy, probably that forage, not only energy and protein as well, and how that can impact their resilience. And we have a lot of breeders here that know that much better than I do, but it's very difficult for you to manage just one aspect and not touch the other one. You know, they will come together. I think, on my personal opinion again, you can go up to a point. When you get to the point that you are decreasing fiber concentration and making that plant really with good nutritive value, that will hurt the persistence of that plant, I think you cross the line. Because then you have something that is good, but it became annual or biennial and is not perennial anymore. And exactly what a lot of the breeding that we have seen lately have happened. We have better nutritive value, but you have less persistence. When you work with annual plants, you may not have that problem because you want the annual plant to go away or it will go away after a year. But if you are thinking about persistence, I think you need to really be careful on that line. And sometimes we see a lot of complaint about this nutritive value. And I think we don't need to go to the breeding. We can work on the management and cover the bases, right? And people in Florida, they are complaining that Limpo grass has very low nutritive value. And that's not the truth. It has low protein, but has high energy. Not high, but acceptable energy. But that happens because Limpo grass is in all wet areas. And when they harvest the Limpo grass for hay or silage, it has been 6 months regrowth interval. So, and then you are complaining that this plant has, you know, limited nutritive value. But when, if you have some management in place, you can probably offset that, those problems. I think that's important, but that's a line there that is very narrow, I think. Thank you.